This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing my oral history interview with Dr. Jim Evans. Today's date is the 1st of June, 2004. I'm in the interview room in the Special Collections Building on the campus of Texas Tech in Lubbock, and Jim is speaking to me by phone from Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Hello. How are you?
Very good. Jim, I just want to ask you a few questions that call upon your perspective as a veteran and as one who's looking back on his own military service. And the first of these really is a big-picture question. It concerns the United States' commitment to South Vietnam in the first place. Was that commitment well-conceived?
My feeling is that the U.S. did not consider the French experience
mm-hmm.
in Vietnam. You know, the French have been there, you know, or had influence maybe 150 years. And you know, what was their experience?
Right.
And the other thing is, after Dinh Bien Phu, you know, how, you know, what were the North Vietnamese forces, you know, how strong were they, where were they, you know, how much of the South was involved, that, you know, if it, you know, after Dinh Bien Phu, it looked like, you know, the South was already, you know, very well compromised, then what's the point in, and you don't really have, you know, government to work with,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
or an infrastructure to work with.
Did it seem to you that either at the time of your service or as you've given thought to it subsequently, that the South Vietnamese government, who was our ally and in support of whom the United States made that commitment, was not strong enough to sustain the competition from the North?
It just seemed like, you know, the South was very fragmented.
Mm-hmm.
The VM was, for want of a better word, basically a mandarin that, you know, he didn't really have much, you know, he was from, I guess, what he thought was the ruling class and
right.
didn't have a lot of skills in terms of getting people involved. And his family, how do you pronounce NGO?
No.
No.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, there's corruption.
Right, right.
So, you know, that was, you know, he was not a very strong leader, and particularly with the family as it was. You know, maybe immediately after, what, 1954, he was probably maybe an okay, but, you know, clearly later, you know, he really was not that much of a leader. I mean, that's part of a sort of layer reading, but...
Mm-hmm.
You know, my feeling is, you know, with history, is like you look at a region, what was the history of the Vietnamese in relationship to the Chinese, you know, or other neighboring countries? You know, what does history tell us
mm-hmm.
about unity or disunity?
And, Jim, what sort of impressions have you been able to form, if any, and I know this would be based on your reading rather than, of course, any kind of firsthand diplomatic experience, but, you know, what impressions have you formed about the Chinese role in the conflict? And should the United States have made a different assessment of that role than it did?
I think the fear was China would intervene.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that caused the U.S. government to hold back and not be more aggressive in dealing with the North. Because it's more than likely it also reflected what happened in Korea.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of a feel that, you know, there's just sort of a lack of appropriate military aggressiveness to deal with the situation. And there are, I mean, there's too many limitations.
and that had operational significance for American forces, obviously.
Right.
Yeah.
Because it just seemed like there was too much interference.
Do you think the United States would have paid attention to the French experience a little more closely if, say, relations between the United States and France had been better in the early 60s or in the mid-60s? If, you know, if de Gaulle could have communicated more directly with, say, the American administration, do you think that might have led to some changes or not really?
It might have, but it just seemed like relationship with the French had always been sort of prickly.
Yes, uh-huh.
That it's love, hate. You know, de Gaulle was very, very difficult from, you know, what I read.
Yeah.
And, you know, I really don't know. It's just,
it's definitely one of those kind of unknown factors. I myself kind of go back and forth about it as well. I suppose that the fact that the United States did not have a great relationship with France was not helpful. Anyway, one can say that. Jim, can you make any general observations about the relationship between enlisted men and officers, things that maybe you saw on the ground, some of which we've touched on, and other things maybe just that arise from your just having been there. Was the relationship on the ground in the American military in Vietnam while you were there a healthy one? Was it something that needed to be overhauled? Was it problematic case by case?
The experience I had in Quang Tri,
mm-hmm.
you know, looking back, it was very, very scary in terms of the number of fraggings that occurred within one battalion. You know, it was like at least 1 month that we heard about either. You know, several of these, you know, were in Quang Tri. There was West Point company commander graduate, you know, captain. And he just didn't really care about it. You know, he's going to just issue orders and tell them what to do.
Right.
But I remember at Thanksgiving, his men were out on the bunker line at Quang Tri. And Colonel Miller said, you know, what have you done about Thanksgiving dinner?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're having sea rations. And Colonel Miller says, you will get them a hot Thanksgiving meal out on the bunker line now. And, you know, he did.
Right, but only because he'd been ordered to.
Only because he had been ordered to. And he was injured later story was a Claymore mine had been set up by his hooch and got him and a lieutenant, it may have been Hodgkins, I'm not really sure. They were not killed, but they were severely injured.
Mm-hmm.
One of the medics, there was another incident where one of the NCOs, one of the line companies, you know, was assaulted by enlisted men out in the field and got decked. And this is a guy that I'd seen earlier who's complaining about a bad back, and after he got hit, he fell, fractured a vertebra.
Right.
So, and then one of my medics sort of got hit when he was in the company commander's office for D Company in Quang Tri. So I just lobbed in a grenade, apparently. And the company, you know, commander was not there.
Right, and this medic happened to be in there.
The medic, he was pulling charge of quarters, and he was in there.
Right.
So you have a photograph.
Yes.
Actually, several photographs of him that in the last, you know, he was back out of the country and,
right.
you know, he survived.
And you would hear, in addition to these incidents, Jim, you know, I gather you heard of others in other companies, other locations where stuff was going on.
Well, there's not that much communication between, the, like, the various battalions.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't hearing about it. But the other thing I was dealing with was I was getting threats that if you don't profile me, you know, so I don't have to go out in the field, something may happen to you.
And you took these seriously. I mean, this was not...
Well, with everything else that was going on, I had to regard it, you know, as very serious.
Yeah. And I know this is a difficult area, Jim, but were any of those... any of the times when you had something like that presented to you, did you feel that there was any animus against you personally, or was this just you needed to fulfill this requirement or need for the person who was, you know, issuing the threat? I mean, was it about you personally, or was it because you're the doctor and you had the power to get them off the line?
Well, right. I had the power to write a profile.
Okay.
So, you know, I could say they weren't fit for field duty.
Mm-hmm. And in general, was there a kind of a culture or an environment that was setting up these confrontations between the enlisted men, you know, and say a physician like yourself, you're an officer, you're a doctor, you have some authority and some powers. I mean, but was there something, what was going on such that an enlisted man would feel, you know, I don't know if no compunction is the right way to put it, but would feel enabled to, you know, go ahead and present you with a threat?
Well, it's, you know, the war was theoretically winding down.
Mm-hmm.
We had no evident mission or function.
Okay.
And I was going to the briefings in the evening for 1st of the 77th Armored Battalion, and it's like I don't remember them ever stating a mission about what they were doing. And it just seemed like they were meandering around the DMZ for no particular purpose. And I think the men felt, you know, this lack of purpose, lack of mission. And they didn't want to get killed or maimed given the circumstances.
Like apparently for nothing?
For
that
nothing.
Kind of feeling?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it would have made a difference in attitude? I mean, this is what's implied by what you said, that a difference in attitude might have arisen if there seemed to be clear objectives and if those objectives were pursued and everyone was sort of walking in the same direction toward the same goal.
Well, I think that there had been clear objectives and that you'd have a military objective and you wouldn't have to deal with all of the, you know, political minutia, like about you can't fire here, you can't fire there, you can't pursue into the DMZ, you can't, you know, all these things you cannot do that ignore the military reality. And, you know, I certainly don't have any, you know, any experience about that, but just in terms of maneuvering, it didn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, and I was reading, like, in Blues Bastards, and, like, you know, they went out to Mutter's Ridge, and NVA had them zeroed in. So why would you keep on going out to the same place
and that kind of purposelessness or whatever seem to also not just be that, but also in some way handed an advantage to the enemy, because when you couldn't shoot it in a certain place, that let them walk through there with impunity, and when you couldn't, you know, follow them, you know, beyond the DMZ, then that allowed them to retreat there and recoup or regroup or whatever it was they needed to do.
Right. It's, you know, I think, you know, they were saying, you know, you want to fight with one arm or both arms tied behind their back. If, when, you know, seeing convoys in the Laotian Panhandle on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, mm-hmm. like, well, you can't fire on them. They're neutral.
Like what? I mean, we're again, just in your observation or you know, impressions that you formed, were people in command positions, officers, equally as concerned about being hamstrung operationally as enlisted men obviously had to be?
I don't think they let on.
Is that right? Okay.
But the thing is, I was not around, you know, the people in the battalion, you know, that much.
Uh-huh.
In terms of, like, the executive officer or the battalion commander to, you know, hear what was going on sort of moment to moment, because all I was hearing was, like, at the evening briefing.
And would you hear anything that was outside that official sort of line of narrative from the briefing room?
No.
Not really? Huh.
One of the reasons I ended up leaving Quang Tri was, first of all, that, you know, I could do it. But after we came back from the DMZ in January 1970,
mm-hmm.
we weren't doing anything. I mean, there were no rumors. Nothing was happening. And so I left about the 5th of June, and within a week or two, the brigade, or at least part of it, moved out toward Quezon. But I just had the feeling that, you know, part of it was like, you know, we're sitting still. There were no rumors, which is, I mean, it just, I guess, like, it was eerily quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I mean, there were no rumors. And then suddenly there's this order to move out toward Quezon, I guess, June or July.
And what, Jim, what did you think that order was going to bring down on the unit?
Well, the, you know, Quezon was this, you know, very scary place,
mm-hmm.
that people remembered from 68.
Absolutely, yes.
And I remember the concrete signpost, QL9, for Quezon. It's like, you know, can't believe, you know, here it is. It was not that far away, but, you know what happened? They went out there, basically, not anything happened. But I guess what didn't make sense was when I was in Hong Kong late April, early May 1970,
mm-hmm.
it was a Cambodian invasion.
Right.
But there was nothing comparable up north until probably late June or July.
By up north, you mean cross-border into Laos.
Yeah,
you
know, like, right, you know, mm-hmm. from Quang Tri province.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess for me, it's like, you know, it's like if you're looking at a supply line, why do you go for the terminus rather than, you know, the neck of it? You know,
right.
Go closer to the beginning.
Right. Did you give that much thought at the time Jim, or is it something that your attention's been more focused on as the years have gone by, thinking about it, reading about it?
I think it's been since then, because first, I think I was not exactly that aware of where I was.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
And that, I mean, there was no, you know, introduction or, you know, the, where I was going, why I was going to Quang Tri.
No contextual sort of setting.
Right. There's no setting. There was no, but it, there, like with positions, I mean, there was no, you know, they said, we just need someone at Quang Tri. They need two battalion surgeons. And no particular consideration for background. You know, the view was, if you are a physician, you can practice anywhere.
And just sort of plug you in to whatever hole there was that needed to be filled?
Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess what bothered me was, you know, I was very quickly on helicopter flights out over the jungle. And realize, you know, if we crashed, I'm cooked.
Right.
I cannot, I don't have no idea what to do. And Dr. Pusler said, well, it didn't bother me. I had jungle survival training. Like, yeah, maybe you did, but the rest of us didn't.
And by virtue of what did he have that training, whereas you did not? Do you know?
I really don't know.
Okay. When did you guys discuss this? When you were here with us? It would have been in March, I think, of 2004. And was he surprised at your reaction, which was that you had not had that training?
No.
Is that right? Huh.
Well, it's the feeling I have is, you know, to me, this is sort of the, you know, the unawareness or lack of awareness that, you know, I experienced when I was in the Army. That I can remember when we were at Fort Sam Houston. A, you know, full bird colonel gave a talk one night, you know, let us know what it's like in Vietnam. And that, you know, when he landed, somebody met him at the airport, and they drove him in the Jeep, picked up his luggage, and, you know, he had no concept of what a captain would experience.
Right, right.
So, I mean, we had really no introduction to what was going to happen. And we just got dumped.
Yeah. Jim, let me ask you about another area that in some way picks up on what you just said, and that is the longer-term implications of U.S. military involvement in Southeast Asia, either on a sort of, you know, national policy level, you know, or on a personal level. I mean, what has been the fallout from the experience of the United States troops being sent to Vietnam?
I think a tremendous amount of mistrust. From people who served. Mm-hmm. And just, I think it made people very cynical. And more than likely that was quite, that was very reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
And I know for me, it's like, you know, the government cannot be trusted.
Mm-hmm. And is that, Jim, from your perspective, because the government didn't handle that situation well, or because simply didn't convey to you what you were involved in and why? or a little of both, maybe?
Like a lot of it's like the lack of explanation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I said, the view was, if you are a physician, you can practice anywhere. But there really wasn't a good orientation to what it's like to be with a battalion before suddenly you're with battalion, you know, in a combat zone.
Right, and you're a physician who's had no training really for handling combat environment, right? I mean, is that fair?
Right. I mean, when I was at Parkland, we had a lot of trauma patients, but I was not I was not really in charge of management
mm-hmm.
or triage.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the experience I had was once I got into the situation, okay, I can do this.
Right.
When I worked in the emergency room at 91st Evac, you know, we would have mass casualties, and you'd just triage patients, like determine who does what, when, where, and who can be saved and who cannot be.
Mm-hmm.
And you just sort of, when that happened, you just sort of went on automatic.
Mm-hmm. And I think we talked a little bit before about the kinds of injuries that you saw in that situation with the 91st EVAC at Chu Lai. But, I mean, these were different injuries than you would see or did see at Parkland in terms of, you know, car accidents and that sort of thing. I mean, these were different injuries.
They were different, and the severity of the injury was typically far worse.
Okay. And actually, just to clarify, Jim, you were doing triage at Chu Lai as well?
Correct.
Okay, and...
Actually, when I was with 1st to 7th Armored Battalion, we were not getting casualties.
Right.
Because if there were casualties, if they were out in the field, the medevac or dust-off helicopters picked them up and took them in probably the 18th Surgical Hospital.
Uh-huh.
So I saw very few direct casualties, except for a few when I was at Charlie 2 when they got rockets. But generally the rockets, you know, they weren't aimed well. Everything on the base was fairly sprawling, so
mm-hmm.
the probability that it hit anything was pretty low. But every now and then somebody would get hit. But, you know, those casualties were minor.
Right, relative to...
Yeah, just like small shrapnel wounds.
Mm-hmm. And, Jim, while we're on this,
mm-hmm.
I mean, did you have to... was there ever a time, particularly I would think at Chu Lai, where you had to, in triage, make a decision that a certain patient just was not going to make it? And you had to devote resources in some kind of crisis situation to those that you thought probably would?
Yes. If someone was clearly dying,
mm-hmm.
You might have to, you know, see whatever that could be done for comfort, but the priority was the men that you could do something for.
Okay.
And in terms of stabilization, stopping blood loss. So what we did there was assess the patient, stabilize, got the appropriate surgical care, whether it's orthopedic or neurosurgery,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, did the paperwork, got the patient, you know, to x-ray for, you know, x-rays of appropriate area.
Sure. Uh-huh.
And, like, piping across my edge for blood.
Well, Jim, do you think that the nation has sort of, in some historical sense or retrospective sense, kind of come to grips with the Vietnam experience at all? Or do you think that it's still something that's kind of out there, if you want, haunting the haunting America at this point?
I think it's haunting America. Look at, in view of the current presidential contest.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I'm guessing there that the reference you make is to the press attention of both given to both candidates' national service during the Vietnam
exactly.
era.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And what about the parallels that have been drawn, again, largely in the press, between the American commitment to rebuilding Iraq after the downfall of Saddam Hussein and the commitment to trying to prop up South Vietnam? Do those parallels strike you as reasonable and ones that should be explored? Or is it just completely fallacious and not a good line of argument?
I guess my feeling is both for South Vietnam and for Iraq that we didn't belong there to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
In view of the history of the area,
mm-hmm.
and for Iraq, where there was no strong evidence for involvement with Al-Qaeda.
Uh-huh.
And what's the history of Iraq? What's the social history, religious history, cohesiveness? I think those are some very similar questions.
Mm-hmm. Let me turn, Jim, to a question that that as a physician and as a veteran of the Vietnam era, you may have some particular insights or observations to offer, and that has to do with whether the United States has extended what you would see as an appropriate level of care to Vietnam era veterans. And I'm talking here specifically about the Veterans Administration. I mean, what's your view of the VA?
I guess the feeling I have is that I don't think we've ever particularly taken good care of veterans.
Okay.
It's like, okay, you serve, and then, it's over,
mm-hmm.
and go away if you're injured or whatever. I think, the experience I've had sort of indirectly with knowing about the VA here in Dallas is that the staffing comes from medical school.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that creates a very different circumstance than other VA hospitals that are sort of like out in the boonies. I mean, there's one, I was still open, Bonham.
Mm-hmm.
That in terms of staffing, it's like in the middle, was in the middle of nowhere. And he got put there because Sam Rayburn was from Bonham.
Uh-huh.
But I think in situations like that, probably the medical care is not very good.
And is that a matter of funding or institutional commitment or political will, or do you have any observations about those kinds of issues as to what is at the root of these kinds of problems?
I think it's funding. I think it's awareness. And parts like this, make the veterans go away. Warehouse them. But we don't want to see evidence that get an amputation.
I see. Uh-huh.
Or whatever it is.
Uh-huh.
That, we don't want to be, wish to be reminded.
And is that something that you've come across in, you know, just in your own sort of journey as a Vietnam veteran?
Well, part of the experience is like, you know, don't talk about your experience.
Right.
Just make it go away.
Right.
Unless you're talking to someone else who's been there. We'll just get over it.
Just kind of disappear it in some way?
Yeah, make it, you know, mm-hmm. Let us rewrite history and make it go away.
And, you know, Jim, what would it take to change that? I mean, for not just veterans of the Vietnam era or earlier conflicts, but, you know, also to go forward. I mean, the Iraq conflict at this point has, you know, deployment of, you know, getting on toward 140,000 active service personnel that are there at any one time. You know, when those people come back, was the situation going to be any different? Or does it depend on the outcome of the war?
I think it's going to be dependent on the outcome of the war, but I don't see there's going to be any particular difference.
Okay. I mean, over the years, the VA, like the rest of the American medical community, has had to, you know, make some changes and accept some, you know, accept the fact that veterans had some illnesses that perhaps, you know, certainly hadn't been anticipated and were thought to be socially unsavory in some way. And I'm thinking about PTSD and AIDS.
What's the first one?
PTSD, the recognition of post-traumatic stress disorder, and and of course the AIDS crisis in this country in the 80s and 90s and continuing on into the present. And I wonder if, from your vantage point as a physician, you saw you know, anything in the VA's response to these problems. Agent Orange is another that was commendable. Was there anything there that was good policy?
Oh, I'm just thinking about the example of Agent Orange,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, it took outside pressure, you know, for them to begin to acknowledge that there was a possibility that I think the initial view was, okay, the veterans are just making all this up.
Right, uh-huh.
Rather than, you know, taking a look with, you know, the neurologic problems that developed after Desert Storm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, the same situation that the VA and the government are like, well, you know, you weren't exposed to anything. You're making it up. That's, you know, it's not real.
Right.
You weren't exposed to this, you weren't exposed to that.
You just want some more benefits or something.
Yeah, exactly.
There's an implicit accusation there that you're, you know, somehow veterans were trying to freeload or, you know, I don't know what, something not good was implied there.
Well, it's like, you know, it's called secondary gain.
Uh-huh.
That, you know, whatever the veteran is seeking is only because of, they don't want to work.
Right. Uh-huh.
They want the benefits, and they're making it all up.
Right. And is that a part of the invalidation that, I mean, is that an element of what we've been kind of talking about, which is the you just make it go away kind of thing?
I think you just make it go away. It's like, it's not real.
Yeah.
You are making it up. This isn't, you know, whatever you're experiencing in your body is not real.
Do you feel the same thing has operated in the government's management of the MIA issue? Or is there something different happening there?
think, I guess one concern that I've gotten more particularly lately is that our policy as we were withdrawing from Vietnam was driven by POWs and MIAs.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, I think, you know, there should have, the driving force should have been military.
Was that a miscalculation that was driven by politics? Or
I think it was driven by politics.
Uh-huh.
And I read William Westmoreland's autobiography.
Uh-huh.
And he says, you don't get concessions from the enemy by being nice. That if I don't bomb you, you will do this. I mean, in terms of military history,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you want a military result or you want a political result, then you have to apply military pressure and continue to do
mm-hmm.
so.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than saying, well, I won't bomb you.
Right, withholding.
I'm withholding
yeah.
rather than.
But at any time I could, if you don't do what I want you to,
right,
which allows them to not do it.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, he was, okay, we held that long enough, the U.S. won't do anything. So it's, but, you know, a lot of this is retrospective.
Sure, of course.
It's very
course.
Difficult. I certainly had no perspective when I was in the military.
Well, you know, I think just from having spoken with you and we've exchanged a number of letters and so forth, I mean, there were things that absolutely you were thinking about and that were before you. And if we could just talk about some of those for a moment.
Okay.
I think this would be interesting. For example, Jim... I mean, I think it's fairly clear and will be clear to people who study the materials that you've deposited here that you're an accomplished artist. And I wonder what role artistic expression was playing for you, even before you went to Vietnam. I know some of the works that you're planning to place here at the Vietnam Archive are from a period in 1969 before you went to Vietnam, and some are from afterwards. Can you express something about what role your own artistic work was playing for you during that time period?
When I looked at what I did right before I went in the Army,
mm-hmm.
I realized, you know, now, you know, sort of the emotional depth of what was there. I was not aware at the time. One of the pieces
okay.
I'll be giving is Plaster Paris, and it's got, I just, on the back it says Youth, and it's dated September 1969, and they're just like mementos of youth.
Mm-hmm.
Because I knew that once I went in the Army, my life would be forever changed.
Mm-hmm.
There's another one that's a cast in my hand with the peace sign.
Mm-hmm.
There's another with a fist. And you know, I realized sort of the emotional intensity of what was being expressed in my art at the time that I didn't necessarily realize. And I was also doing a number of paintings like Jackson Pollock that are just like, you know, it's chaos, you know, painting and swirling colors,
mm-hmm.
which I did before Vietnam and I did in Vietnam.
And what were you letting out with that, Jim? I mean, as you think back on it now, what were you saying with that, even if it was only saying it to yourself?
I think it's just all, it's just chaos. And in some ways, with the, you know, paintings that just sort of dripping on the canvas, they're just swirling, and in some ways, no real purpose.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I guess part of the feeling I had at the time was like anybody could drip paint on canvas. Mm-hmm. That, you know, sort of purposelessness, mm-hmm. meaninglessness.
And that was sort of what the experience of being in, you know, commanded to be in the army, what was doing to you, how it was making you feel?
Right. Just kind of, there was no purpose.
Yeah. I don't know if it's the case that that during those years you were writing, but I know again from material that you're depositing with us that that in these later years you have done some very good writing about the things that Vietnam experience has called up in you, or things that happen that call that experience out of you. And I wonder if writing is something you've always done.
Not that much.
Really?
It's probably been more lately.
Uh-huh.
I've always written, I guess, letters.
Right.
But, you know, at one point I thought, well, maybe I'd like to write about my experience in Vietnam, and I realized, you know, I had some material to write. I didn't have that much. That basically what I had was a lot of photos. And, you know, the photographs, you know, in some ways would speak better than mm-hmm. some of my words.
Well, I think they speak together, actually, quite forcefully.
Oh, okay.
And I'm not trying to put too fine a point on it, but, for mm-hmm. example, the incident in 1997 on Christmas Day, which you've told me about, where a Vietnamese man driving in his car sideswiped your car, and this was you know, quite a compelling moment for you, not only in terms of what it brought up for you on the day that it happened and on the days afterwards, but it's also something that you've written about in poetry. Can you say anything more about that incident?
Well, I think part of what it is, you know, then I started having flashbacks and mm-hmm. realization, okay, it's time to deal with this. And I was getting involved with some men's workshops
uh-huh.
and was able to create rituals related to dealing and feeling. I think I was reading Men in the Water of Life by Michael Mead, you know, who talks about rituals. It talks about the initiation of war and, you know, sort of how different people who've gone to war deal with it. I sort of created a unique ritual of putting three loaves of bread on the altar, which is a non-specific altar. But so, you know, when I was on my journey, I could use the loaves of bread symbolically to distract the lions that I had to deal with. Yet, you know, so once I felt it, dealt with it, then I discovered the lions were toothless. That, you know, a lot of what I feared was something I had created. And that once I dealt with it and faced it, it took a lot of the power away. It was really an amazing find.
Absolutely. And if I'm following you, you found that you had the power somewhere to overcome, and that generating a ritual or a practice was a way of expressing that. Is that fair?
Yes. And the sort of the first ritual I created was, you know, I was being massaged, and I told the two men who were giving me a massage, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to be going back to Vietnam to feel it and to let go. I will be yelling and screaming. I may be crying. Keep on with touch. Basically, don't let me fall off the table. But,
yes.
You know, this is what I'm doing. So there may be a lot of noise, but, you know, don't worry. You know, this is something I'm doing of my own free will, and, you know, there is a purpose for doing this. So, I mean, my feeling was it pretty much worked. You know, it's not an absolute, but it did make a huge difference.
And let you get to a place where freeing up and turning loose some of that stored up, you know, stuff, I don't know what to call it, could just go.
Right. And it's an ongoing process.
Yes.
And it's like letting go of the photograph, letting go of the memorabilia.
Mm-hmm.
But that's part of healing. That feeling like it's, you know, has a place in history in terms of, you know, other people who contribute, you know, to give a very big view.
Right.
But it's also a personal way of letting go. And it's like, I'm so glad that I have done it. And my friends have said, we're glad you did it.
You know, I'm sure that it won't come as any surprise to you to know that, and this is one of the really the most difficult things to do with a number of veterans, people we've spoken to, is that they'll carry their Vietnam pictures around in their vest pocket and have them all the time. And not just when they come to the Vietnam archive, but you know, they have them, you know, with them all the time, and surrendering them in some way. It takes a big leap for some veterans to do that. It's a very difficult thing.
Well, what I've done I've been asked to create rituals with some individual men.
Okay.
And you know, part of what I tell them, and part of the ritual is, you know, if you're wanting healing or whatever you're seeking, you have to be willing to give something up. And just like the balance in the universe, that if you're wishing to be healed from a wound, you have to yield, you have to give up your wound. One man was, you know, getting into middle adulthood. And, you know, his intention was to think of himself as a mature man. And I created a ritual where, you know, there were some symbolic references to being a child, to being a young man, and that he, like, you know, creating a gate, you know, little, you know, fairly small, and just said, you're too big to go through. You are a grown man. You'll have to knock it down. And you know, he was rather stunned. Well, it's like, I don't want to do that. But, well, you know, we cannot proceed unless you let it go. You have to knock it down. You have to let it go.
And Jim, how if I can ask, do other guys come to ask, to ask you to help them in this way? I mean, do you have retreats, or are there groups, or how? I mean, are these friends that you've known a while, or
most of these were in a group situation?
Sure.
Where there'd be organized activities,
okay,
and there would also be an opportunity for men to have specific rituals,
mm-hmm,
and to appoint a ritual master.
Okay, to seek out someone particularly.
To seek out.
Okay.
This is what I want. This is what I'm interested in. The ritual master then asks questions about the purpose,
uh-huh,
of the ritual,
uh-huh,
and then creates the ritual.
And on this sort of, you know, extremely personal basis, you know, very, very, you know, idiosyncratic in the best sense of that word, this is part of the journey that you've been on as well to manage what's come up for you since 1997.
Yes.
Okay. Jim, if I can just sort of widen the discussion a little bit, I want to ask a question. I don't know whether it's anything you've given thought to or not. And this has to do with the contemporary relationship between the United States and Vietnam. I'm sure you're aware that diplomatic relations have been established between the two countries and going on 10 years now. And I just wonder if you think that's a good thing.
The feeling that I had when I was in Lubbock,
mm-hmm,
was it felt very good. That, you know, there is a past, and then you move beyond the past.
Right. Uh-huh.
And, you know, it just felt good. I mean, when there was, you know, description about, you know, scholarships for students,
mm-hmm,
who are in Southeast Asia. But, yes.
Right.
I mean, it felt very good. And I think PBS, maybe a week or so ago, had a show about raising a U-boat that was sunk off the Danish coast.
Mm-hmm.
And the British crewman on the airplane that sank it and the crew of the U-boat who survived got together, you know, when this was raised. And it coming to a place of, you know, friendship,
mm-hmm, yeah,
that's the past, it's over. And as one of the British crewmen said, you know, we were not trying to kill the men, we were trying to kill the U-boats. And so, you know, just, you know, what I was hearing when I was at Lubbock was like, you know, this is about healing.
Mm-hmm.
And the war is over. Let us move on. As, you know, as well as is practicable.
Right. And, you know, recognizing that not everyone moves in the same direction at the same time, but still trying to find points of reconciliation.
Well, exactly.
Is important exercise. Yeah, I agree. Jim, would you ever, have you ever given consideration to going to Vietnam again?
I mean, sort of in the back of my mind, but I guess my feeling was that, you know, the ritual I created,
uh-huh,
was what I needed. And
uh-huh,
I actually have a lot of concern about, you know, service people who go to Vietnam seeking healing when, you know, I don't think healing happens in a geographic location. Make healing happens within us.
Mm-hmm. And by saying that you have concerns about them, is it, and I'm just offering this, is it that you think the possibility is that they may go over there and be disappointed, or that they may go over there and go through, you know, have spurred some, you know, potentially climactic kind of episode?
I think they could have a climactic episode and not have care.
Okay.
It's, I think, similar to, you know, Vietnam veterans who are working through their experience and who have never been to the wall. That, you know, in terms of, you know, like being in a group, you know, whatever support is necessary, and that they go, you know, within that support system.
Right. So there's a safety net in a way.
So there's a safety net, but also that a lot of healing has already occurred.
I see.
So when, for example, see the Vietnam Wall, you see the brothers and sisters you lost there, that you have prepared yourself emotionally. Doesn't mean you're not going to feel something, but you are prepared, you know, to be with it.
Well, Jim, on that point, I wonder if there are any points that we haven't covered that you would like to add.
Actually, I think that's pretty well covers it.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for participating in the Oral History Project, and at this point, we'll conclude.
Okay. That sounds good. I certainly have appreciated the opportunity and your kind attention.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jim.
Okay.